Hey scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk
with Matter Private Network. During current restrictions, don't ignore your health concerns. Our expert team is ready to help.
Anyway, have you ever thought of something that is literally right under your nose? Once you start thinking about your voice, it can reveal fascinating secrets about who you are. This Is the Voice is a compelling non-fiction book on why our voices make us, humans, the most dominant species on the planet. So what exactly is the voice and how did it originate? The author of the book is John Colapinto, who's with me on the line now. John, good morning.
Good morning, Jonathan.
How did you set about this? Because, I mean, it's so obvious, yet at the same time is something that everybody takes for granted and nobody gives consideration to the power of that which we all have, our voice.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there was a few different things that happened. I wrote a story in The New Yorker about a vocal surgeon who actually saved Adele's career by removing a little polyp from her vocal cord, a little bump. And the editor at Simon & Schuster said that would make a great book, but I immediately realized no, it wouldn't, because it would be too difficult to really get my arms around the subject of the voice, because the voice is not just our vocal cords. It's not just that sound that we make. You know, it reaches out into sociology, psychology. It's a projection of our inner self. It really, you know, tells us things in accents. And, you know, I'm sure if your listeners just for a moment let their mind range over everything that the voice is doing, they'll feel very much like I felt, which was, I mustn't go anywhere near this subject. But I couldn't stop thinking about it. And that's partly because I have an injured voice myself. I used to sing as an amateur, and I also got a polyp, much like Adele's, even though my singing isn't as good. And, you know, I realized this is affecting my life. People are hearing sort of a raspy Bukowski-esque character, and that's not exactly who I am. And so, you know, all of this tumbled together. I thought, what is it about the voice that ultimately I can say that is new and fresh? And I suddenly realized it really is the voice that carried us to the top of the food chain. That's why we dominate. It's how we can control these noises we make.
Every animal makes a noise, from the dog to the cat. But fish don't. But funnily enough, your journey on understanding and explaining the voice goes back to fish.
Jonathan, when I was doing my research thinking, should I tackle this? When I read that our voices really begin with the lungfish 400 million years ago, I thought, okay, now I've got to write this book. It's a creature that was the first one to leave the sea and be an air-breathing creature on land. So it's our oldest ancestor. They lived in shallow water environments, so they were susceptible to suffocating to death during droughts, because they couldn't breathe air. Of course, you know, there was a genetic mutation in one of those fish that enabled it to draw a little bit of oxygen from the air. That was passed down to its offspring. More of those fish appeared that had this advantageous mutation. And so you suddenly had a creature that could both breathe in air and also under the water. Its flotation sort of bladders inside its body, if you think about it, they're very much like lungs. Well, that's where our lungs came from, symmetrical bladders on either side of our spine. But what really happened in its throat was the most interesting thing. Gills line the throat of the creature. Well, it developed a little hole so it could breathe into those rudimentary lungs. There was a problem. When it went back into the water, it could drown. So that little hole became a valve that could open and close, open for breathing on air. Now, if you take a valve like that and you push air through it when it's closed, you'll get a sound like, well, I can't do it. You'll get a spluttering sound. sounds a little like someone passing gas, to be perfectly honest, because it's a sphincter through which air is being blown. So I regret to inform your audience that the first vocal sounds heard on Earth were probably very much like a fart. But it was in later species that became more, you know, developed and more complex, that simple little valve became this remarkable instrument that could go high and low in pitch, because it could tighten or it could loosen and slacken. The breath became more sophisticated as we developed a diaphragm as mammals. So you put all of those things together and you end up with a voice like ours that can go high and low and loud and soft.
And as we evolved, we learned how to communicate using that. The funny point is we've reached the point in our evolution now where the voice is the predominant decider in whether or not you believe someone is authoritative or not. How have we reached that point? That you can see somebody, you can look at them, but you're more interested in what they say rather than what they look like.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, because that social signaling system that is consistent across really all animals that use their voice, it really developed an ability to suggest authority and suggest size, really physical size, which is really how this began in the voice, by a size bluff. If you lower your voice, it gives the illusion of a bigger body. Think of how a cello is bigger than a violin, you know, and the violin is actually boosting higher frequencies. And that's what we sound like when we want to sound loving or submissive. So you really end up with this kind of, I don't know what you'd say, psychological or emotional social range through low to high pitches and everything in between. So that's where we're picking up so much signaling from someone speaking, quite apart from the words.
You talk about in the book the voice of leadership and how that matters. And there's a very contemporary context you put on that. The former US president, Donald Trump, and how he would behave and deliver his message versus a man we talk about a lot on this particular program when we're speaking with Luke O'Neill, Dr. Tony Fauci.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Fauci's interesting to me because he had a vocal polyp, which he had removed, and his voice immediately became smoother. That happened last year, so I was fascinated in that. But those two voices, when you would hear Donald Trump say, speaking about, well, virtually anything, but during the COVID crisis, you had a man whose voice had a deliberate snarl in it, whose voice sounded sarcastic or it sounded hostile when he would accuse a reporter of being politically correct because he wouldn't remove his mask. You really had someone whose, just the very sound of his voice was undermining everything about the authority of the other person who would then speak to us, Tony Fauci, about the necessity to wear a mask, and who was bringing to bear all sorts of scientific knowledge that he had accumulated over decades of his life, where he was telling us in reasoned tones about what we really should be doing. So here was a situation in which, yes, the words were, in both instances, were telling us opposite things. But so much of what we were getting from those presentations and that we get from all voices of leadership is really those animalistic, you know, social signaling that I was talking about earlier, hostility through a lower pitch or higher pitches can also be used in a hostile way, incidentally. But it's how we blend all of those things to create this very complex signal that, you know, some people respond to thinking. I mean, a lot of people liked Donald Trump. So that really suggests, too, that the voice is a two-way social signaling system. It's a transmission device, but it goes into this receiver of the ear, and you get this feedback loop that creates who we are.
Yeah, it begins in the womb, really, doesn't it? Because I've always found it fascinating how babies respond to their mother's voices, even when they're only a couple of days old. It's not massively noticeable, but you see that flash of recognition, that I know that person moment, from having listened to the mother. The father doesn't necessarily get a look in, but the mother does. And do you think that that bond with the voice forms at that very early stage when we're in the womb and we're, I suppose, in the safest place we'd ever be for our lifetime?
You know, it just makes so much sense, doesn't it, that mother's voice is so important, because who's going to feed that child? I mean, when you're first born, the only thing that matters is the female breast. You must get sustenance, and that's where it's going to come from. As mammalian creatures, the word mammal is from mammary gland. So why is the voice so potent for children? You know, it's interesting. Our hearing has developed in the final month or so of being in the womb. It's fully developed. We can hear. So the baby, or we'll say the fetus, is hearing the sound through the mother's wall of her abdomen. But that's not the only way the voice is being perceived. Her voice, as she speaks, is making her entire body vibrate and rattle. And so that sound signal, those vibrations are passing through her skeleton and right into the womb. As fetuses were floating in amniotic fluid, which is set into motion. So our entire body, when we're just about to be born or in that final month or so, is actually perceiving the voice as felt sensation that's vibrating against every part of our body, our feet, our legs, our faces, our abdomen. So we are getting the voice in through the ear, but our entire body is feeling it. And if you think about it, we're in a dark environment where nothing else is felt. The only signal we're getting is that mother's voice. And I mean, evolution and you know, natural selection don't do these things randomly. I mean, that baby is being encoded. It's being taught. This is happening for a reason. The baby is then born. And when it hears the mother's voice, I mean, of course, it's just going to latch onto it. And so, you know, that's critical.
Mm. Do people then view others differently? And I suppose that goes to your insecurity, John, which I can assure you, having listened to you, don't need to have, because your voice puts across a beautiful eloquence when you're talking about this topic, that people perceive if they have an accent, or if, you know, they might have a stammer, they might have something else that feels as if it's restricting them, that because they perceive their voice as somewhat weaker, that has a massive and probably bigger impact on them and their personality than they realize.
Well, what a wonderful observation. I wish I had actually gone into that more in my book. I think it's implicit in everything I'm saying between the lines. But yes, I mean, just think of that, how a stammer, you know, makes you feel anything, I guess, that makes you self-conscious about this signal that you're sending out. It's ferociously undermining for the individual. I mean, it's funny, in my own instance, and my voice is actually sounding smoother this morning. That's one of the terrible things about these polyps, is sometimes they're bad and sometimes they're not so bad. But I would be phoning someone, maybe as a journalist, maybe a mother whose child had been shot. I was doing a story about kids and guns. And I wanted to sound like a sympathetic character that could earn her trust, to open her up to, you know, to speak to me. And if I'm growling like Charles Bukowski and I sound like some sort of a character from The Sopranos, it's just not what I want to be sending out as a way to get her to speak to me. So you're so right. I mean, what we're doing with our voices so much of the time is actually trying to elicit behaviors from other people, cooperation, trust, mating. It might be that if we are a politician, we want to get their vote. But if we feel, and there are so many reasons to feel, as you point out, through accents, stammers, stutters, whatever, if we feel that something is impeding that signal, it's terribly undermining. Yes.
It's a fascinating topic. It really is. And it's a great book. It's called This Is the Voice by John Colapinto of The New Yorker. John, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for getting up very early where you were to talk to us this morning, and have a lovely day.
What a great pleasure. And I love listening to your accent, if I may say so. Or maybe I'm the one with the accent, you see.
To be fair, there's a lot of people listening right now, according to text, who don't like my accent. So there you have it. There's a good broad church out there. John, pleasure as always. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with MilliQ Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.